Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. In part two of this special mini-series for new investors, I'll be discussing investing in shares with Hamish Carlyle from Merlin Capital. The goal for this week's episode is to provide the tools and the background needed in order to get started investing in equities. Hamish is an excellent communicator and has written some of my favourite pieces of stock analysis on Livewire this year, including why Telstra could be worth less than $2 and how CommBank managed to destroy $53 billion of shareholder value through bad acquisitions. In this episode, we discuss what makes a great equity investment, some important skills and concepts for new investors to learn, and he talks us through a current practical example of an investment that he thinks is materially undervalued. If you've got any family members or friends that have been asking you about investing, then this is for them. Please consider whether you know anyone who might benefit from this content and send it their way. And as always, please subscribe to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and visit our website, livewiremarkets.com. Before we get into the podcast, I hope you'll excuse me for including a quick disclaimer, the full text of which can be found in the wire for this podcast on the Livewire Markets website. The information in this podcast is current as at the date of publication. It is intended to be general information only and not financial product advice, and has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Hamish, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Thank you very much.
Of course, we're discussing new investors today. We're doing a bit of a guide. This is part two of our mini-series. So today we're going to be focused on equities and in particular, analysing equities. Hamish, of course, this is a subject that you're very, very strong on. I really enjoy your content on Livewire. It's really easy to understand, really analytical and really insightful. So hopefully we can communicate some of that to the listeners today. But to start with, let's talk a little bit about what makes a good equity investment. Now, I know there's a huge amount to unpack here, but let's keep it kind of high level and principles based first of all. Could you give us, say, whatever the number that your firm works with, say, around three or four core attributes that you think are the essential characteristics of a good equity investment?
Yeah, it's as you say, it's a complicated question, and there's never a right or wrong answer to that type of question. And I think, you know, having, you know, people have been looking for systems to beat the market forever, and there's been a lot of people a lot smarter than me, you know, academics and the like, try to come up with tools and techniques that work consistently through time. So it is difficult. The underlying principle for any investment is that there has to be some misperception in the market for a company or a stock to outperform. That would stand for equities or anything else. And I think one of the great misunderstandings is, you know, a good company is necessarily a good investment. It's nothing to do with whether a company is a good company or a bad company or growing fast or growing slow. It's all about market expectations and outcomes relative to market expectations. So from a principal perspective, I think being humble about that is very important, and acknowledging that the market is mostly efficient. So, you know, the vast majority of the time, the market has an unbiased and accurate view of expected outcomes. That said, you know, we're always looking for circumstances where the market may be too pessimistic. If the market's too pessimistic, over time, you know, reality will perform better than expectations, and investments will ultimately come good. The things that we tend to look for when we're thinking about, you know, always asking that question, are investors too pessimistic about this particular company? Valuation is a useful starting point, because if a stock looks cheap, the odds are that the market's quite pessimistic about the longer term outlook. The second thing we tend to look at is, you know, is the market extrapolating short-term trading conditions too far into the future? And, you know, it's quite common in our observation to see circumstances where there'll be a cyclical issue or, you know, a disruption of some sort or a, you know, a temporary dislocation in terms of the competitive dynamic that means that a company is not performing at its full potential. And as humans, we do have a tendency to extrapolate shorter term conditions too far into the future. So I'd always be thinking about, firstly, valuation, and secondly, you know, are current conditions negative, which sounds counterintuitive, but typically we tend to, as people, extrapolate negative conditions too far out into the future. Other observations, I mean, you know, people do become very worried about short-term risks, sometimes to the detriment of the long-term. And, you know, if you're always worried about what could happen next week or next month, you sometimes lose a sense of the bigger picture. So, you know, we're always looking for valuations. We're looking for signs that maybe people are extrapolating things too far out into the future in a negative sense. We're looking for concerns about risk. We're scanning as a final point, you know, media and broker reports, including your column, you know, to think about, you know, what is the market telling us, and are investors, you know, becoming overly pessimistic? And there's a lot of great case studies in history of industries that have, you know, performed quite terribly over very long periods of time, but have been fabulous investments. And I think I talked about in an article I wrote a few years back about the US railroad industry, you know, that was deemed to be, you know, obsolete as a result of aeroplanes. But of course, as investments, the railroad stocks turned out to be one of the greatest investments you could have made amongst all US stocks over the next 20 years. So everything is about recognizing, you know, you only make money when the market's too pessimistic, and, you know, you can look for indications that may be the case.
Yeah, that railroad is really a great example of a misperception. Of course, Buffett himself has made a large amount of money investing in railroads. I think you've partially actually already answered my next question. I was going to ask you, you know, to break down each one of those attributes and how to measure or assess them, but I think you've given the answer of the misperception. You assess that by valuing a company. That being said, maybe we can delve a little bit more into that instead. Now, I know we don't have, you know, time to go in depth on valuation in this, though perhaps we might be able to provide some further resources for people to read if they want to delve into that more. Just keeping it really high level, which type of approach do you favor for valuing a stock? And are there any common approaches that you think maybe aren't ideal? Because we're trying to keep it a bit simple here, could you maybe explain to us what the difference is between cash flow and accounting earnings from a conceptual point of view rather than from a technical point of view?
Well, in the long run, they have to be the same. That's probably the first point to make. So if you think about a 100-year period, the aggregate of all accounting earnings and the aggregate of cash flow should be the same. And so the accounting profession is engaged to smooth cash flow, to try to create a more normalized view of the business. And in doing so, you are necessarily introducing subjective concepts. So if I spend $1 billion on a new building, I have to make an assumption for accounting purposes about, you know, how many years that building's going to last, how much it's going to cost to maintain, and so on and so forth. So it's subjective. The other critical distinction that's become a massive issue over the last 20 years has been the difference between statutory earnings and management measures of profitability. And the US has stricter rules around this, and you can see a giant wedge in S&P 500 earnings between what are called operating earnings and statutory profits. And it just means that companies whether they do it deliberately or not, I think they do, but not always consciously, will always have a tendency to overstate the profits of a business. And so they'll take write-offs below the line, you hear about a lot. Whereas cash flow is cash flow. It's an objective measure. It's much more volatile, but it's real.
Just to explain that term, below the line, for the sake of the audience, usually refers to anything that kind of sits in between operating earnings and your statutory earnings. So the company's not counting it as being an expense, but because the regulations or the accounting rules require them to report that, it does have to come in to that statutory number.
And there are some great examples of that that are just obviously wrong. So things like ignoring share-based compensation from profit when it's clearly a cost of employing staff, or ignoring, you get the idea.
Yeah. No, I was actually just going to add to that and say another one we see a lot of is write-downs. They're not real expenses, but that it's real money that's been spent on those on those assets that have been written down.
That's right.
Well, look, let's talk a bit about the skills that you kind of need to develop as an investor. There's an awful lot of them, but what do you think are the most useful skills for an investor to develop? And, you know, what are the kind of resources that they might be able to use to learn this?
I kind of break it probably into there's technical skills. So, you know, accounting, finance, that are really extensions of sort of high school math, but, you know, they're a necessary but insufficient toolbox to have. Those skills can be developed either as an investor or in commerce or through self-learning. And that's probably the most common skill set across the market and therefore the most essential, but also therefore the least valuable in terms of trying to differentiate yourself, because you come back to this idea that you only really do well out of an investment if you can identify a misperception, which is seeing something that others can't see. The second bucket I would say is more business analysis skills, which are the basic, you know, things you'd pick up in an MBA, whether it's Porter's Five Forces and frameworks for thinking about, you know, competitive advantage, and really understanding drivers of long-term returns and the types of attributes you'd think about when thinking about, you know, whether a business has the right to even exist, whether it's going to be around in 20 years, and how defendable its market position is. And there's a whole lot of jargon around that different fund managers and different consultants have, whether you call it economic moats or barriers to entry or whatever else. So I think that's kind of the second piece. And I think, you know, one of the challenges I see is trying to link the two pieces together. So, you know, it's not always the same person that has the two sets of skills and the ability to integrate the thinking around some of those qualitative attributes you'd look for when you're analysing a business with some of the financial concepts is challenging and rare, but it's very powerful. And then, of course, the third piece is really this concept of investing, which is about identifying misperception in the market, because that's really what investing is about.
More the psychological aspect of it then.
Partly psychological and just recognizing you can have, you know, I can spend days, and I do, and analyzing a company, and I'll ultimately understand the company possibly better than anyone else, or 90% of the investing population, but it doesn't make me a good investor. It's a matter of taking that knowledge and trying to think about, you know, is it truly insightful relative to the market's current understanding of the business, and is it meaningful within the context of the investment proposition? And that's the hardest part.
Yeah, it sure is. As Marx says in his book, you have to think differently and you have to be right. It's easy to think differently, but to do so and to be right is the hard bit.
Yes.
Well, look, I know a lot of experienced investors like yourself have rules of thumb or helpful little shortcuts that can assist them along the way as an investor. Of course, any rule of thumb isn't going to be universal. You know, they are their guides and shortcuts, and it's important to remember that. But I'm curious, what is, you know, do you have a favorite rule of thumb that served you well as an investor?
Look, I feel like when we think about things, you're trying to indications of misperception, and we touched on valuation as one. And a great tool for us and for me has always been, we're always throwing things at valuation scenarios and saying, well, what if we're wrong? What could we get wrong? And I often think about when you've thrown everything at an idea or a potential investment and it still looks cheap, then you're probably onto a winner. There's no certainties, and things can always get worse before they revert back to your way of thinking. But I can think of a number of instances where, you know, you've thrown the kitchen sink at an investment in terms of what could go wrong, and it still looks cheap, or it still looks interesting. And that's ultimately how you preserve capital over the long haul, because you've at that point you're buying a business that, even if everything goes wrong, it's going to be a decent investment. If things go half right, it's going to be a really good investment. And if things go towards your sort of central way of thinking, it's going to shoot the lights out. So we're always thinking about, let's throw everything at it, and if it still stacks up, it's more likely to be a good one.
That's a good rule. I like that one. Let's talk a little bit about the technical side. I don't want to spend too long on the technical side of things, but I thought it could be interesting just to talk about, say, maybe three important concepts in accounting or equity analysis. So we talked a bit about cash flow before, so that, I guess, is one of them that we've already discussed. But could you pick a couple of important concepts, either in accounting or equity analysis, that you think an investor really needs to understand this, and just explain in as simple terms as you can what it means?
Yeah, look, I do will sound like a broken record, but opening up the cash flow statement in a company's annual report and comparing the operating cash flow minus the company's capital expenditure, and comparing that with the company's advertised profit. So take that number, which you'll find buried in the middle of an annual report, and then open up the company's PowerPoint presentation and look at the first number that they advertise as representing the company's performance, and calculate the ratio of the cash flow to the advertised earnings. And I mean, that single measure is probably one of the most enlightening measures you could look at. I was looking at Telstra before we came in here, and the cash flow represented 39% of what the company called EBITDA. And so, you know, to me, that's the starting point is, as an investor, you're getting 39 cents in the dollar for everything that the company says they're giving you. And then you look at the company's management and think about the way they're incentivized, and they're incentivized to grow EBITDA. So I do think that that's a very telling measure. And Buffett had, you know, some great quotes about, you know, thinking about cash flow, because these accounting measures are interesting, but if you put yourselves in the shoe of an owner, which you are as a shareholder, if you think about owning the entire company, the only thing you really care about is how much cash flow the company delivers you at the end of each year, and that is the return on your investment. And that is very much the way I think, you know, we need to be thinking about investing. Otherwise, we're really just speculating. So I do sound like a broken record, but I think just taking the cash flow and comparing that to the PowerPoint presentation is a really powerful measure. And you'll get a range of different numbers when you look across the Australian market. I think the average ratio is probably around 70%. So most companies are overstating earnings by, you know, a factor of 50%. And so when one investor says this stock looks cheap, I might look at the cash flow and say, well, you know what, I don't think it looks cheap at all, because it's only converting 40 cents in the dollar. So that's a really interesting measure. And you're not even thinking about valuing the business. You're just kind of thinking about management's integrity and the way they're representing profit. And I think a lot of the time the market's over-reliant on management representations, particularly as you touched on towards the tail end of a bull market where people are generally feeling more optimistic about the world and more confident in their own abilities as investors. So that's a big one.
There's certainly no need to apologize for, as you say, sounding like a broken record. I think when a concept is so important, it's often good to repeat it so it gets stuck in your head. I know I certainly don't necessarily learn or remember something from hearing it once, but if you hear it a few times, it can be helpful.
Yes.
I just wanted, for the sake of the audience, to quickly explain one of the terms that you use there, which is EBITDA. It stands for earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it's essentially just it's a form of earnings that excludes a number of items that management often thinks are not important. Now, you'll need to judge for yourself whether they're important or not. Personally, tax and interest and depreciation I consider to be pretty important things to consider. But, you know, that's what a lot of management teams like to present as a measure of the performance of the business, I guess. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other way I think about it is the measure. The other way to think of it is it assumes that either there is no capital expenditure requirement for the business, which is clearly not, you know, not a realistic assumption. And it's a measure that's used, again, more frequently towards the later stage of a cycle. It's used by investment banks to justify higher and higher valuations for transactions. And, you know, we need to be vigilant, we need to be skeptical.
Yeah, look, I mean, surely there are situations where it might be appropriate to exclude depreciation. Like, for example, if you've got assets that don't need replacement, that have a high depreciation cost, and so your capital expenditure is much, much lower than your depreciation, but you still need to consider that capital expenditure regardless, even if it is lower than your depreciation. It's a real expense. It might not go on that income statement all the time, but it's pretty hard to deny that capital expenditure is real money that costs you, comes out of your bank account. So let's talk a little bit about holding and selling positions. It's one thing to buy a stock, but knowing when to sell it and how long to hold it is an entirely different question. And for a lot of people, it's really quite tough. So just as a rule, you know, keep giving us a few principles to work from here. Typically, how long would you expect to hold a position? And how would you know that it was time to sell that position?
I think there's no rule. I would come back to this idea that so long as there are misperceptions in the market, and so within the context of owning a company, so long as the market remains pessimistic about the outlook or too pessimistic about the outlook, then, you know, we would continue to hold the stock. And, you know, that may be for a year, it may take 10 years. And if it takes 10 years, you know, that's fine if the company's generating cash flow and generating a return on its cost base. The things that I would look at are the, you know, similar comment I made earlier, going into a position, you always throw everything at it to see what you might have missed to the downside. And, you know, when a stock is owned, often it's useful to go down the same path, looking at what you might have missed to the upside. And so, you know, I'd be thinking about, you know, what might we have missed to the upside, but I'd be thinking much more about, you know, is there evidence that the market remains too pessimistic? Because if the market is not too pessimistic, then, you know, even if the stock delivers on all expectations, it's not going to prove to be a, you know, superior investment. So I'd come back to those points I made earlier. We'd be looking at valuation as an indication of pessimism. We'd be looking at current operating conditions, because if current conditions are very good, there's a high likelihood the market's extrapolating those good conditions too far out into the future. We'd be looking about whether, you know, we talked earlier about market becoming excessively concerned about short-term risks, but if we saw indications the market was becoming apathetic about short-term risks, and we talked earlier about, you know, negative broker or media commentary in relation to a stock, if the commentary was overwhelmingly positive, then it would be an indication that, you know, maybe be sensible to exit the position. So, you know, I'd be very much looking at what I might have missed to the upside and looking for evidence of pessimism in the market.
Well, let's put it all into practice and talk through a practical example. Could you explain to us an investment that you've made and what is your process and your thinking along the way?
I mean, I think one of our highest conviction stocks now is AMP, which if you go back to some of my earlier comments, you know, we talked overarchingly about, you know, what makes a good investment is overwhelming pessimism about the outlook for a business. And, you know, when we think about, well, what are the indicators of pessimism? I talked about valuation. I talked about current operating conditions. I talked about excessive concerns about short-term risks. I talked about negative media commentary and broker commentary. So, you know, I think this company would tick all those boxes, and I don't think anyone would debate that. So, you know, it is a really interesting example. I mean, we think the company is potentially worth between $4 and $6 a share. So the valuation argument we think is compelling. The operating conditions are clearly challenged at the current point in time, and there's clear evidence to us that commentators and others in the investment community are extrapolating current operating conditions far into the future, which again is a very positive thing in terms of indicative of pessimism. The concerns around short-term risks, I think, is pertinent. There's actually a number of investors that I admire and talk to that have absolute agreement on a 3 to 5 year view, but just take the view that things could get worse before they get better, which again is I think indicative of a, you know, a behavioral bias that makes it look more interesting. And I think you'd only have to open up today's paper to see negative commentary. So, you know, it fits a number of these criteria, which suggests a high level of pessimism, which suggests to me that, you know, the company doesn't need to do a lot to justify where it currently trades. And if it can do a half decent job, or the management team and board can do a half decent job, it'll turn out to be a really great investment over a multi-year period.
Yeah, you certainly hear that a lot, particularly from fund managers, and it's not hard to see why, given that many fund managers are, you know, their performance is usually measured on 3, 6, or 12 month basis, but a lot of the time they're not willing to invest in something that has a positive long term, but potentially some problems in the short term. So it can present some interesting opportunities.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think, you know, that is the great challenge, and that was, I think Keynes said, you know, markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. And I think sometimes you sort of asked about, well, what can make people into great investors? I mean, sometimes it's a lot easier to manage your own money than other people's money. And, you know, Buffett's made a lot more money managing his own money than he ever made as a fund manager. So there's a lesson in that. But ultimately, you know, it's up to fund managers to educate clients, to align with clients that share beliefs, values, and understand what fund managers do, and hopefully the journey can be managed together. But it's easier said than done.
That's for sure. Look, I've got a couple of fun questions to finish on. So they're supposed to be a little bit lighthearted. I do make an effort to ask all of my of my guests these questions. I usually have a third one, but for the sake of this mini-series, we've just put it aside as I didn't really feel like it was appropriate. But we'll still ask you the other two. So first of all, could you recommend any good books for somebody who's just getting started as an investor?
Yeah, there's so many good books. I think the Berkshire Hathaway annual letters are still absolute gold, and they're all on the website. They're all free, and you know, I still find little nuggets in there that, you know, you can apply to different situations. So I think that's, and you can see the way, you know, Buffett's thinking evolved over many, many years. You touched on earlier about that sort of more, he talked about it as cigar butt investing, where, you know, you're buying very, very cheap companies and holding them till they revert to some more sensible level of value to much more now focus on quality. But I think there's so much in that. I like Seth Klarman's Margin of Safety is the other book I think is fabulous. But, you know, there's so many. And once you kind of find what sort of fits with your personality, you'll find ample reading.
Now, I normally do not condone piracy, but when it comes to Seth Klarman's book, should probably give the listeners a bit of a warning. Buying a copy of that book, I hope you've got very deep pockets. Last time I looked, the copies that were available secondhand ranged between $2,000 and $5,000 each. So you might want to look for some alternative sources there unless you're prepared to spend a lot of money on acquiring that book. It's out of print for a very long time. And a lot of people would like to read it. Have you got a copy of it, do you?
Yes, I do. I do.
Lucky. I'd ask to borrow it, but I don't think you'd lend it to me. All right, one more question. If you could give your 25-year-old self just one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
I think I think putting real money to work is the foundation, and your own money. Until you've got real money invested, everything is theoretical. And I think because, you know, we've touched on a lot of these behavioural challenges that we all deal with as investors, and a lot of that's centred around loss aversion and, you know, some of the emotions that come with losing money. It hurts, it's painful. And so I think being able to separate yourself from that emotion is a really challenging part of the business. And you know, you won't feel that till there's real money, no matter how many spreadsheets you've got and how many paper portfolios you've looked at and everything else. So I think getting some real money to work's a big one. I think being humble is important. I mean, markets are, you know, as I said up front, there's people far smarter than most active fund managers that have tried and failed, you know, to come up with systems to beat the market or exploit vulnerabilities, and it is hard. And so having that always at the front of your mind is really important, because again, there's this just tendency when we do well, we attribute it to our own skills, and when we don't do as well, we attribute it to, you know, bad luck or whatever else. But being able to kind of be humble and steer the course is important as well, and taking a really long-term view. I think just, you know, you touched on it as well. I think the pressures around short-term performance are getting worse and worse and worse. And I think with the current generation, people tend to have jobs these days for 3 years at best. And so, you know, your incentives as an investment manager with a three-year window can be very, very different to your end investors' objectives, which is a challenge for the industry to deal with as well. But just keeping that personal perspective on the long term is very important.
Yeah, no doubt. It's a challenge for some of the companies you invest in as well. I remember reading not that long ago that the average tenure for a CEO in a large company these days is about 5 or 6 years, which doesn't really sound like it's long enough to make significant change in a major organization.
No, and it's not. And I think this all these behavioural characteristics that we suffer from as investors, the boards and management teams suffer from equally. You always, I think this is Another great Buffett quote is you really want to invest in companies that idiots can run, because you can be virtually certain at some point idiots will be running them. And so it comes back to just understanding the industry structure and the competitive advantage, and people are not, management is not a source of competitive advantage.
Well, that's actually all we've got today. Hamish, thanks so much for coming on the show, for sharing your thoughts and your insights into how you think.
Thank you very much for having me.